I'm Theo Greenlee, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUCB, where I work in on Alaska, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Alaska has long ranked at or near the top in the nation for rates of violence and sexual assault. Over the summer, lawmakers updated Alaska's sexual assault laws, including a new definition of what defines consent. The law went into effect on January 1st. Why did it take decades to update the statutes, and how might the changes affect prosecutions? Better legal tools to prevent assaults and help survivors is our discussion today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska. In rural Alaska communities, village public safety officers make a difference every day. Hired regionally, VPSOs are trained in public safety services such as community policing, fire prevention, life-saving emergency medical response, and search and rescue. VPSO receive competitive pay, benefits, and opportunities for advancement. To start your career in public safety and learn more about becoming a VPSO, go to vpso.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by VPSO.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Has Alaska's high rates of sexual assault been at least in part because of an outdated definition of consent in state law? Advocates for Better Protection say yes, and they say the changes to the law that started at the beginning of 2023 will help. Here to clarify what the legal changes are and why they think it could help prevent sexual assault and bring more prosecutions when they do occur is former State Representative Garen Tarr, who was instrumental in pushing for change. Also with us today is Keely Olson, the Executive Director of Standing Together Against Rape, or STAR, and Eileen Arnold is the Executive Director of the Tundra Women's Coalition in Bethel. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Thanks so much for being on hand. You can also join the conversation. Do you have questions about the law change or thoughts on what else may be needed to bring down the rates of assault in Alaska? You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So it's tough for me to refer to you as Garen because I'm used to saying Representative Tarr, but since you're a former representative, start us off with an overview, Garen, of what happened. Describe the changes to the law.
Well, folks may be familiar with the idea of affirmative consent, and a big goal for us in rewriting the law was to achieve affirmative consent. And the underlying thinking with that is really, you know, a very human rights, equal human rights kind of frame where each individual has the right to decide if, when, and with whom they will encounter a sexual act. And that fundamental right is something that belongs to each person. And sadly, over the decades, that fundamental right has not been afforded to all individuals equally in the law. And when I learned about that, I have to give credit to STAR, Standing Together Against Rape, and their incredible work in Alaska. This was identified as one of their legislative priorities. And they really started this conversation. And once I learned the potential in making this change, I was 100% committed to achieving this change.
As you noted, it's the conversation that has been ongoing. In an earlier interview, you noted that the conversation has been ongoing every year with every governor and every legislator. Why has it taken so many decades to get this change done in a state that is at or near the top in rates of sexual violence against women in the nation? The law was written 45 years ago.
Well, it was not easy to get it changed now. I will just tell you that. And so we might think that it took a long time, but I worked on this for 4 years and it passed on the last day of session and was among the last things to happen in the last legislature. So it took every bit of energy, effort, dedication, passion, commitment that every person who was willing to stand with me and work on this was willing to put forward to get it passed. And I think for me, what I had to understand initially was to put myself in the mind frame of 45 years ago. You know, what were people thinking when they wrote this law, and how could we have gotten it so wrong? Well, if you put yourself in that time frame, you don't have women elected officials in very, you know, substantial numbers at all. You've got very few women serving. So you think about the conversations that might have happened around sexual assault and sexual assault law. More importantly, what was also happening is just the movement to actually classify these crimes as a crime. The first rape kit wasn't even used until 1978. Prior to that, these incidents were happening, you know, often an individual would show up at a hospital and what they would do is, you know, have that individual take a shower, you know, basically wash off all the evidence. You know, we had to really reform these systems to first even establish that these were crimes against a person. Then, you know, what came after that, and this is reflected in Alaska with the development of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault and the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, was just then trying to learn the extent of the problem, like understanding the culture around that. This isn't just a family problem. We can't stay silent. We have to bring it into the open, talk about it. It's a crime against a person. It's a trauma. It's a lasting impact. So once we started to learn about that, well, of course, we needed to respond because we learned so many individuals had been harmed and assaulted. And that created the whole system around the domestic violence shelters and sexual assault response operations like STAR. Well, you know, we've been working so hard at responding to the high numbers. It's left very little time to work on the prevention and the change in the culture that is so necessary for us to achieve the lasting change we want. This effort gives us a new benchmark in that effort because now we've achieved that human rights frame in the language and the way the law will be applied. And now we have this incredible opportunity to transform the culture in Alaska around sexual assault, to really educate people, to have those important conversations. And I just get very excited about the potential for change.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about changes to Alaska law. House Bill 325 was signed into law on July 28th of 2022. The law makes significant changes to Alaska's sexual assault statutes, including how the state of Alaska defines consent. The law went into effect on January 1st of this year. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255. Statewide, that's 1-800-478-8255. In the Anchorage area, the local number is 907-550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email questions or comments to talk@alaskapublic.org. With us today to discuss the passage of this law is former state representative, Democrat Garen Tarr, Keely Olson, the executive director of Standing Together Against Rape, or STAR, and Eileen Arnold, the executive director of the Tundra Women's Coalition in Bethel. So carrying on there for a moment about how long it took to change a law, and that context, the historical context, was really helpful. As you noted, Garen, that it was mainly men that were in those positions 45 years ago. And so the conversation was quite different. Our understanding about trauma wasn't as developed as it is now. But Keely, you noted in a previous interview that the previous law required that force had to be used to prosecute rape. That was removed from the federal definition years ago and from many other states. Again, it seems strange that it's such a Herculean effort here in a state that has such consistently troubling high numbers. Your thoughts about that?
Well, it wasn't an easy lift, and it really took finding someone like Garen, who was willing to do the heavy lifting and not be dissuaded from the effort. And it was sort of Herculean, but she had, you know, a lot of energy around it, and she, you know, engaged people from all over the state. She wasn't trying to rewrite the law on her own in a glass bubble. She was going out and having, you know, statewide meeting sessions, public sessions, collecting all kinds of ideas and stories. Unfortunately, people sharing their experiences of having been sexually assaulted and then how it didn't raise to the level of violating the law. So she got to hear from people all over the state and their lived experiences, which was what Star was trying to bring to the table with our policy priorities. I talked to everybody in the legislature and certainly every representative from Anchorage. And Garen was the one that picked up the mantle and said, this is going to be something that I'm going to work on. And like she said, it took four full long years to get it accomplished because people said it just couldn't be done.
I don't understand. That's the part that really draws me up short is why can't it be done? Why is it so difficult to change what seems like should be fairly straightforward, just ensuring that people are clear when it comes to saying yes or no and that that's respected? Why is it so hard to get these changes put in place? What's the resistance to these kinds of things?
Well, initially, and I think Garen can talk about this a little bit more, her experience in the legislature, but there was initially a knee-jerk response that there was going to be a high fiscal note associated with this and that there were so many crimes of like this occurring that how would we be able to prosecute all of them? And that begs the question, expense cannot be the issue to public safety. We have to
clearly
do something.
Clearly, it cannot. Yes. Eileen, your thoughts here. How did the Tundra Women's Coalition sort of weigh in this process when Garen, former Representative Tarr, was working on this? How were you involved?
Well, we participated in the legislative team that the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault is, is a part of. We were absolutely supportive of this initiative, and it's a good thing. There's always sort of a patchwork of services and laws and culture change that need to happen to significantly reduce the rates of sexual violence that we have, and hopefully in the future even, end sexual violence. But of course, I'd say out here in rural Alaska, we still struggle with a lack of law enforcement that impacts our response to sexual violence, especially in the smaller communities. And so the law is important, and I'm happy that it's changed. And another thing that we need, to be able to give everybody equitable access to those good law changes is the resources on the ground in the places that sort of are the furthest away, the most isolated from resources.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that law enforcement piece of this. Garen, will there be training for law enforcement and others in the legal system about this change to the law and what it means, especially when we know that survivors of assault have in the past been questioned about what they were wearing, how much they'd had to drink, how they were behaving? It was the guilt or responsibility was put oftentimes on the survivor of an attack. What kind of training will go with this?
Well, I want to share a couple of things on that topic. It is so, so important. And I first want to share an email I received from an Alaska State Trooper when we passed the law. And this email says, Rep. Garen, I've been an Alaska State Trooper for 23 years. I'm currently in Anchorage until Wednesday for SWAT training. Please do me the honor of allowing me to shake your hand. You have made my world so happy tonight. I've had countless arguments with the district attorney office regarding freezing and physical resistance. You are a blessing. Sorry, I have to take a deep breath after that one. That one really hit me when I received that email. The troopers you know, who investigate these crimes, a lot of the law enforcement individuals who investigate these crimes, who respond to these crimes, have wanted the change. They have been struggling with the ineffective law when they respond to a crime and then they know they can't forward it, or once they do, it's not going to be considered for prosecution. So I found the law enforcement folks to be very responsive. As to the question of resources, absolutely. That is an area that we have to continue to improve upon. I look back at my time in the legislature. If I knew what I knew now, I would not have allowed some of the cuts. I would have tried harder to prevent cuts to troopers, VPSOs, attorneys, some of those critical positions, because what we've seen is they are so difficult to refill. It's not as if the legislature just funds more prosecutors or public defenders, and then the next day those positions are filled. It takes months and months and months and years, and we've had to do a lot of really creative things in the budget so far. We've tried bonuses and things like that to improve hiring, both on the trooper side, the VPSO side, and on the attorney side of things, because the people that you need to do this work, we just absolutely have to say that's a number one priority in our state. We will protect those services in every budget cycle. Those will not be areas that we cut. And that needs to be a lesson learned from the work we've done. And then what I want to say is I always try and learn lessons. You know, when I was a legislator, it's like, okay, if we didn't do it right one time, let's not do it again. Senate Bill 91, I would say a mistake there was we did not provide training. I learned that lesson big time. I would never do that again. So when we passed this law, yes, the law was signed in the summer, but you notice the effective date was January 1. That was very intentional. We worked very closely with the State Department of Law to know that we would have sufficient time between the passage of the law and the implementation and application of the law for the people who would enforce the law to be trained. In that intervening time, the annual conference for the prosecutors, public defenders, judges took place. The Department of Law provided training materials. A lot of that work has done and will continue to be done, and we are very committed to that. One of the reasons we want to have these conversations is that we also want to get into community groups, you know, business organizations, any group that wants to learn more, be a part of this culture change that we are seeking, that we think we have solidarity with most Alaskans on this topic based on our conversations and experience. And I'll just say those meetings that Keely referred to, we started each one of those statewide meetings by asking the question, has consent ever been an issue for you? And every single person across Alaska, young and old, rural, urban, said yes to that. So I think there is a lot of solidarity and interest in this. And, you know, yes, we need to put the resources in there, and we are all committed to, you know, fighting for those resources and getting into the community and being a resource for individuals that want to learn and help.
That's really stunning to consider that every single person expressed that they'd had a concern about consent at one point in their life. And certainly gets at the heart of why this is so important to clarify. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Katie is in Juneau. Hello.
Hello. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. And did you have a question or a comment, Katie?
I just wanted to make a comment with Jaron Tarr and Star of Alaska were absolutely fabulous the past 4 years. And personally, they were like my greatest like advocates, and like I can almost consider them as like amazing friends, and trying to help pass this into law. And I just don't know how we could have passed this law and passed this into law without both of them. They're both amazing, and I will forever be grateful for them.
Well, thank you for the call, Katie. I'm sure that I'm looking at Keely right now, and she's certainly appreciating your comments. So thank you for the call. Representative Tara, I want to go back to you for a moment. I know you've got to leave at 10:30, so we want to get you in here as much as we can before you have to depart at the bottom of the hour here. The Department of Law asked you to slow the work down because there was some national work being done in this area of law regarding consent. What was going on there, and has that national work concluded?
Yes, and I was, you know, happy to work with them. I think it was important to have that strong partnership, again, from some of the lessons learned with earlier work. And what was happening is there was a national review of sexual assault laws. A group of attorneys, judges, mm-hmm. you know, advocates and professionals. This has kind of expanded more recently to the number of people who participate in these efforts, but they'll draft what they consider model penal code. And so it's kind of the idea is you brought the best minds together to think about these, and it gives some sample languages that states might consider. This, you know, if you look at some of these laws, to say public safety laws generally across states, you will see a lot of these similarities. And it's because historically, this is how these legal frameworks have been developed. And so you see that sort of consistency among states. So that work was happening, and that work has been completed. We are very consistent with what they recommended in terms of affirmative consent. And even our rape by fraud provision was included in that. We haven't really spoke to that yet, but Keely can definitely cover that. And what they were concerned about, and I was so appreciative to understand this better, is let's not make a mistake that another state has made. If another state has recently changed their law, let's look and see if there's been any litigation around that. And if there has been, you know, let's understand the outcome of that, because why do we want to repeat that mistake? That felt like a very reasonable request. And that's why we spent the first 2 years just studying what other states had done, following that model penal code process. And then, of course, having that series of statewide meetings that allowed more than, you know, 100 people to directly provide input to the drafting of our Alaska law.
Let's talk a little bit about education efforts and how you're working to get the word out about this. You had mentioned, Garen, that there's a big opportunity here to dovetail with education efforts to talk to young people about what consent means. Talk about how you see that unfolding.
One of the most fun parts of this was working with a man named Brian Hoskin, who is the head of the Alaska School Activities Association. They coordinate a program called Coaching Boys into Men. They've just recently added a program that will be for the athletes on the girls' sports team called Athletes as Leaders. And what this program does is it works some, you know, themed-based education components into each athletic practice. And it really builds on the idea that student athletes are often school leaders and can help be influential in their school community. Now, there are many incredible young people in our schools, and I think all students should have access to these programs. But in terms of primary prevention, this was a program that we received some grant funds for a number of years ago and then have been able to continue offering under now the ASAA umbrella. So in their suite of weekly activities that they do with their sports teams, they have educational materials on healthy relationships and consent. And one of the things we talked about with them was it was very difficult that what they were trying to teach the young people was inconsistent with what the law said, you know, and that this was a big problem because it's confusing, right? You think that if this is what we say it is, this is what's commonly understood in our community to be consent, then the law should apply that frame, that kind of thinking. Well, that's not what was the case. So Brian was one of our huge supporters. He was one of the people who testified at all of our hearings. You know, he was always there. I've attended some of their trainings. They're very excited about the potential for now, you know, helping these young people understand, hey, here's what we're saying and here's how the law implements what you're learning. That's just one example of the programming that can happen with our young people. I think there's huge opportunity with the Student Government Association, the Children's Advocacy Centers that are a statewide network, certainly STAR, and I hope Keely will have a chance to speak to this. They do amazing programming in our schools. They already have a lot of important information about consent. But what we have to remember is what was happening before is even if you were teaching people this, say someone engaged in that behavior, they may have gotten away with it. There would have been possibly no legal response. So even if they thought they knew what consent was, you have to think, how do people's behaviors change when they're able to get away with something? What we learned through the rape kit reform is, unfortunately, there are many serial offenders and people who will get away with things they know they can get away with. And so, you know, you really do need a law that's effective in capturing and prosecuting the behaviors that we find unacceptable. And so, you know, our young people, they're learning this. This affirmative consent is what's commonly taught now for young people in the more sort of modern, I guess, definitions of consent, if you will. FRIES is an acronym that's often used, coined by Planned Parenthood, that means freely given, reversible, informed, enthusiastic, and specific. That is what our law says now, without the worst of use of the word enthusiastic, which is not something you probably put into statute, but suggests that same theme of willing participation. And so it's very exciting. There's consistency there. It's a paradigm shift. It will ensure responsibility and accountability when those actions aren't followed.
And I do want to get Keely and Eileen in to talk about their educational efforts with young people. But I know that we're going to have to let you go here in just a few minutes. So, Garen, I want to get another question in for you before the bottom of the hour, and then we'll move on to our other guests after that break. Women in Nome got involved in raising awareness of the failure of law enforcement there to adequately deal with sexual assault cases. You heard committee testimony from Nome women who said they've never known what it feels like to be safe in their community. Talk about what you heard and what was the reaction to that from other committee members?
Well, just when you say that, it just sends chills.
Yeah.
Through me. It just feels so wrong. I really come at this from a human rights point of view that, right, each individual has a right to safety. And to think that the indigenous people of this land would be living a life where they've never felt safe, that is a major human rights violation. And what an honor, what an incredible honor for me to get a part in trying to right that wrong. That was tremendous, tremendous honor for me. And what I wish we didn't have to do is ask individuals to come forward and have to share those kind of stories and have the kind of courage and just sense of self, you know, to put yourself in a legislative hearing and share from such a deep and personal way. So I just want to express my gratitude for their willingness to participate, not just in one, but two, three, four, five or more hearings over years. Also to Katie, who, you know, was willing to share her story in her home community of Kodiak and then again in the legislative halls in Juneau. So it's deeply impactful to me. I think, unfortunately, sometimes the legislative world, people get a little desensitized to some of the stories because they're a little bit more consumed in the busyness of the day. And kind of that format maybe doesn't always allow people to really experience it in a more personal way. For me, I often had people calling me after committee hearings, very, very upset just by some of the questions they heard. I would say, unfortunately, some of the hearings were even traumatizing for survivors. And I don't think that my colleagues, particularly my male colleagues, would have intended that way. But it just shows you that culture that, you know, I'm not sure if men sometimes experience this. I don't want to suggest that it's not a problem with men. One of the most disturbing stories I heard right as I worked on this came from a woman, and her college-age son had been sexually assaulted and with very significant impact on his life, of course, and hers as well as the loving mother. And so I don't want to suggest that. But if we think about pop culture, we think about movies, we think about TV shows, just sexual assault of women is a common theme that is played out in a way that is not, I think, showing the level of seriousness and the lasting impact it has on people's lives. Along the way in this work, an attorney shared this with me, that a rape is like a murder where the victim lives. And I think if you start to think about it in that frame, you might really understand what's been taken from a person from a sexual assault. And sometimes, unfortunately, in the legislative world, until someone knows someone that it's personally happened to, it doesn't kind of connect them. But that's why we have to talk about it, because with the rates of assault we have in Alaska and just generally, everybody knows somebody. You do know somebody that has been impacted by sexual assault. Absolutely. You may not know it, but they're a part of your life and we can do better for sure.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I know that you have to leave and we are going to go into a short break here. Thanks so much to former State Representative Democrat Garen Tarr for her work on HB 325, the law that was passed that updated Alaska's sexual assault statutes. Thanks, Garen, for being with us. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Keely Olson and Eileen Arnold as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Southeast Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will develop proposals to change federal subsistence hunting and trapping regulations and discuss other subsistence-related issues. The public is invited to participate in the meeting February 28th, March 1st and 2nd in Juneau. More information at 800-478-1456. Or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about updates to Alaska's sexual assault statutes and laws. And we just finished talking with former state representative, Democrat Garen Tarr, who was instrumental in pushing this forward and getting this update changed in law for Alaska. In the studio with me is Keely Olson, the executive director of Standing Together Against Rape, or STAR, based here in Anchorage. And on the line, Eileen Arnold is the executive director of the Tundra Women's Coalition in Bethel. And we're going to continue our conversation now. But let's go back to the phones for just a moment. We have a caller from Anchorage. Hello, Jed.
Thank you for letting me on the show. I want to say thank you very much to Representative Garen Tarr for all the work she did, because too many people, too many women are traumatized by men who do things that are wrong. And by raising awareness and changing the law, Garen Tarr has done a great service to the state of Alaska. So thank you very much for Garen Tarr.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Jed. I want to get back, Keely, to kind of recapping what exactly the change was so that people understand what we're talking about with this update that is quite significant, mm-hmm. but might be difficult for people to really understand. What does this mean? So help us kind of recap that.
One of the simplest ways that I can explain it is that prior to January 1st of 2023, a degree of force had to be present and be able to be proven by district attorneys in order to say that a sexual assault occurred. So when you have a prerequisite of force being used, that also implies that you would have injuries. And then you would also have an implication that those be visible injuries. We know from our experience as advocates and responding to emergent cases of sexual assault with law enforcement, forensic nursing, that that is so often not the case. There may be a delay in reporting, people wrapping their heads around what happened before reporting, being nervous about reporting, afraid that they may not be believed. And then they come forward, they you know, may not be able to express that they were forced against their physical will, that they were held down, tied up, those kinds of things that our law really kind of implied had to be present. So just saying no was not considered enough of a level. And I think that that can be, you know, indicative of 40 years ago, that it was primarily men that were, you know, raising that bar to what sexual assault would be. Unfortunately, the unintended default of that is that, people are ready for sexual contact and, sex at any time, all the time, and that's the default, and saying no is an aberration. And that is really what was changed with this law, is to, while sexual assault where force occurs is also still very much the law, it also allows for understanding of trauma responses that prevent people from fighting back. Often what we hear is the general reaction to trauma is fight or flight. And you either run away.
There's another F involved,
you fight.
Isn't there?
Yes. Yes. And so with knowledge of trauma response and the trauma
freezing.
Response across the board of what everyone can experience, one is freezing. And that is especially most common with people who've experienced some degree of trauma like it before. And especially for survivors of child sexual abuse, that freezing was their only recourse. They couldn't fight someone off. So they're more likely to reengage in that form of response to trauma when it happens again.
So are you saying that even if a woman testified before the law change, if a woman testified that she consistently said no, but didn't have any bruises or other signs of trauma, that a conviction might not have come forward?
Well, exactly that, because what we tend to see with sexual assault cases is that they more than likely are going to go to trial, and there's no express benefit for someone pleading guilty to a charge where the state has such a high level that they have to prove. And so when a jury is receiving jury instructions and they're told that force is a natural part of what is to be seen within the law, it implies that there's going to be injury. It implies that there's going to be visible injury. That they're looking for that kind of evidence. They're looking for someone to be bloodied, bruised, and that's just so frequently not the case. But regardless of what the law says, a jury can nullify the results of what the law should be to what our expectations within our society are. And so from movies, from those jury instructions, that sort of thing, you know, individuals kind of have a perception of what they think sexual assault is. It's not the same perception that survivors themselves have, law enforcement has, or advocacy has.
Mm-hmm. Eileen, I want to get you in here now. As I noted earlier, you're the executive director of the Tundra Women's Coalition in Bethel. You said that understanding a trauma response, in an earlier interview you mentioned that understanding a trauma response may mean someone freezes rather than fights or flees, as we were just discussing, that this is an important update. But you also said many people don't really understand what consent means. Talk about that. Why do you think people don't understand this?
Well, I think in the context of sexual violence, like, sex is a difficult thing to talk about, and which means that sexual violence is an even more difficult thing to talk about. And so consent in the context of sexual assault and sex in general is not really understood, because we're not talking about it, because we don't know how to talk about it, because maybe our parents, for whatever reason, whatever way they grew up, whatever their context was for understanding, you know, adult relationships and all that kind of thing, just didn't lend a lot of opportunity for learning about healthy sex. And then same deal for schools. Sometimes schools don't talk about it, either because of the rules and regulations that exist, or for whatever reason. So it's this, like, this perfect storm of a complicated thing that's easy to get wrong, that we're not comfortable talking about, and that we're not educated talking about. And the great thing about this law is that now it's matching up with what we as advocacy have been, you know, putting in our education programs for a very long time. Like, it used to be that we would talk about, like, consent means saying yes. However, in the state of Alaska, you know, forced sex means this. And it's, you know, we would just have to do this ridiculous tap dance to talk about, like, here's the ideal of what you should be going towards, but also just know that the law really doesn't support the dictionary definition of what consent means. So, and that's just another burden on survivors of sexual assault, that you know, what happened to them and what they reported, what they've been taught about what is okay sex and what is not okay sex, doesn't hold up when they report, which means probably next time they won't report. Alaska, as you've been saying, has some of the highest rates of sexual violence, and it's probably higher than what we know because a lot of people don't want to report because of the cultural messages we get about what sexual assault is and isn't, and because maybe they've been sexually assaulted before and they did not have a good response from law enforcement or the Department of Law with screening out a case that wasn't going to go well for prosecution or seeing a case be pled down. So this change in consent law just means a lot of support for those of us who are advocates who have been trying to do this, you know, education about what we want to see sexual relations look like between people for years. And it's a, you know, it takes some of the burden off of survivors. You know, when we were looking for a no before, that put the burden on the victim. Now that we're looking for a yes, that puts the burden on the person who's choosing forced sex.
Thank you. That's an excellent clarification. Really appreciate that. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide if you'd like to join our conversation today as we're discussing changes to Alaska's sexual assault statutes and laws, updating what it means to give consent, and putting the onus on the person that is asking, not the person who is giving or not giving consent. So a change in the law to protect potential folks who might be victimized otherwise. This is considered a big improvement in the laws for the state, and we're discussing how that will play out now going forward. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 907-550-8422 is the number in Anchorage, 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. So talking about the educational piece here, Eileen, continue on. How, when you think about the need, especially to talk to young people as they're starting to learn about having relationships with others and what that means and what a good, healthy, respectful relationship means, are you able to get into schools to help young people understand what clear consent means? Or has this become more difficult given the heat around education and curriculum that we've seen unfold at school board meetings in recent months? How has that been for you working in the YK Delta area?
Well, one thing I'd say is that back in, I believe it was 2015 or 2016, we had another good law called the Alaska Safe Child Act that talked about how youth need to be getting age-appropriate dating violence and healthy relationships educations, and that they have to be getting sexual consent education. And, you know, what the state eventually said was that, like, all districts can sort of do what they want to do, but that they do need to be in touch with victim services and advocacy agencies for our input, which is excellent. And, you know, so for one thing, like, that should be happening at all schools. What the curricula actually looks like is going to be different from place to place. Obviously, all communities in Alaska are very, very different. I will say that we've got, you know, we've gotten great, our experience and our education has been sought by one of our local school districts. The ones that are sort of further out, you know, there's other victim services programs that they can be going to. So that's a good positive thing. I will say, you know, when we were talking earlier about not cutting budgets to things like the Department of Law and public safety and all of that, we need to not cut budgets for victim services or advocacy as well. That, you know, we had a huge scare a little while earlier where VAWA, where the VOCA money really dropped, and the Alaska State Legislature sort of swooped in and helped us out there. But that's sort of something that we're always looking at. Like, not only are we sort of struggling to maintain the amount of money that we have, we're really fighting not to get any reduction. And especially with inflation, you know, man, the cost of my fuel this year has just been painful. The cost of food has been painful. I look at these bills and it's like, wow, we're really spending our money very, very quickly. We can't we literally can't afford any sort of reduction. So, and that's one of the things that I have to make choices about. Like, can I feed the people in my shelter? There's probably something like 40 people in my shelter right now that we need to feed, that we need to, you know, pay to have staff there, that we, you know, that cost money for them to come here. And that impacts whether or not we can go out to schools. You know, in my region, it's an area the size of Oregon, there's 56, 58 individual communities. And, you know, this year we had to sort of stop, like, I don't have the money anymore to spend $1,000 to send a team out to educate in the schools where the rates, you know, we're in Western Alaska, the rates of sexual violence are the highest in our region. And I don't have the money to do education and outreach. I think somebody referred to this as well, like, it's easy to fund response because we understand response. It's much harder to fund prevention because we don't always understand the prevention. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's things that we can do about that. Like, I'm in the midst of applying for federal grants, looking specifically for outreach or looking for any sort of money that will fluff my budget is what I call it, so that I can have money to do the education and outreach in the smaller communities who are asking for them. But in the meantime, like, we have to make choices. Budgeting is it's an art. It's not a science. And if you don't have the money, or if, like, the cost of fuel is eating up the budget, then that means you need to make choices on, you know, what you're doing in a year.
Yes, absolutely. We need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about changes to Alaska's sexual assault laws as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing changes to Alaska's sexual assault laws that went into effect on January 1st. HB 325 changed what it means to give a consent. And we're discussing these changes with Keely Olson, the Executive Director of Standing Together Against Rape, or STAR, and Eileen Arnold, the Executive Director of the Tundra Women's Coalition in Bethel. Earlier in the program, we heard from former State Representative Democrat Garen Tarr, who was instrumental in getting this law passed. Keely, are words, with this law change, are words absolutely required to convey consent?
No, not necessarily. People can show consent through their actions and their behaviors.
Okay. So it doesn't have to necessarily be verbal.
Mm-hmm.
The age of consent is 16 in Alaska. Does the law address older people having sexual relationships with 16 or 17 year olds?
No, unfortunately, the legislature declined to actually tackle that issue last year. It remains a policy priority of STAR. And I don't think that most people throughout the state are aware of the unintended consequences of that. And so when you have someone who is 16 or 17, who has no independent rights of their own, can't get a motel room, can't rent a car, can't drink, often may not even be able to have their license yet, and yet they're treated for all intents and purposes as adults under the sexual assault statute. I frequently refer to it as we throw 16 and 17 year olds to the wolves.
What do you think should happen there? What would be a change that you'd like to see in that respect?
I think the easiest thing would be to raise the age of consent to 18, then have, in our current statutes, there's a 4-year difference of age that is an allowable difference that's completely irrespective of consent. Consent always will trump age, but if people are consenting and they're within 4 years age difference, then that is considered that they're within the same social group. But certainly someone 20, 30 years older than a 16-year-old who goes out of their way to groom them, to isolate them from their family, values and beliefs, isolate them from their friends, make them believe that they are more mature than their age. That's really a recipe for disaster. And it happens at a time when people, young people, are very influenced by folks outside of their home environment. And oftentimes we're receiving calls on our crisis line from parents who feel powerless to do anything to help because they can't go to court and get a protective order on behalf of their teen.
Yeah.
They can't, you know, you can forbid your teen from seeing someone, but if this adult predatory person is offering them a place to stay, et cetera, we're forcing them into their hands. So, yes, we see that as, you know, also a preventative tool, because if someone is assaulted or in an unhealthy predatory relationship at a young age, they're more likely to have recurrent unhealthy relationships as they go on.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Lewis is in Anchorage. Hello, Lewis.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the call.
Yes.
When I was much newer to Alaska, and that's this was back in the 80s, I worked for a technical company which sent a lot of people who were based in Anchorage to about 80% rural and native communities. And someone had us sit and watch a movie from that era called No Word for Rape. And it emphasized the fact that we were going to areas that were culturally very distinct and had their own rules and regulations, and it behooved us to be aware, to be careful. And unfortunately, since it was that long ago, I don't remember details. And I was wondering if anybody there remembered that movie or was influenced by it or had an opinion about it. I found that it simply alerted me to the issues and made me better overall, but they definitely, I mean, the title, No Word for Rape, says it all. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Lewis. And Keely's nodding her head in agreement here. What can you tell us, Keely?
There is a filmmaker through Affinity Films that is based here in Alaska. She worked at Star in the 80s. She responded to sexual assault in hospitals, as well as going out to schools and providing prevention education. And she created that film. And it's really looking at a response to folks who say incorrectly that sexual violence is something that was naturally occurring within the culture of Alaska Native populations. And it absolutely is not the case. It is, recurring as part of historical trauma visited upon our Native sisters and brothers when there was influence from Western society coming into Alaska. And that's why we tend to see higher rates of sexual violence. They never had a word for rape. There was no idea of what was occurring to them. And when you don't have the language to express what is happening when it happens to you, generally at the hands of a white colonialist coming into your community, oftentimes in the form of missionaries and priests, you can't very well ask for help because you don't have a word to express what's happened to you. And so No Word for Rape is an excellent movie, and it is available online through Affinity Films.
All right. Well, thank you for clarifying that. Eileen, we only have a few minutes left here. In picking up on that thought of people who are survivors who have been victimized and how when you have to go through the legal setting, it's very traumatic for folks who are survivors. In updating the laws, was there any changes to that process that a person who was attacked has to go through to make it less traumatizing? Has there been any improvement there?
Well, Well, I'd say not because of the change in laws. I think, like, you know, those of us who are on the ground and advocacy programs and even, you know, law enforcement and medical who, you know, do their additional training and we all learn more and do better as we know better. I think we've all, you know, really worked hard to try to make the process least traumatic as much as possible, even if we couldn't have controlled things that we didn't agree with in the law. One thing that I'm really proud of in our region is that, you know, again, in our area, which is an area the size of Oregon, everybody has to come to Bethel if you're reporting sexual assault. Our team, with money from the federal government, the Office of Victims of Crime, is looking to expand and do SART through Telesafe in some of the sub-regional communities in our region, which are the larger communities that have got sort of a larger clinic, if you will, so that people don't have to come to Bethel, because people will opt not to report because of how difficult it is to get into Bethel and also how difficult it is to get out of Bethel. We've just had fog here for the last 3-4 days. It just downed all the planes. There's no travel in and out. So that was, you know, that really stopped people from reporting or wanting to go through even just the process, because that's another terrible burden on victims. Like, you got to wait, can't take a shower for 3 days until we can fly you out here. So people are just gonna, you know, not do that. So our multidisciplinary team here is trying to make those services more accessible to people. And like I said earlier, this is all about a patchwork of making the services more accessible, changing the laws so that they make sense with our culture today, and also changing the culture of what people think sexual assault is. It's all a patchwork that's, you know, if we keep grinding at it, like, we're going to reduce these numbers of sexual assault. We're going to change people's minds, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to be awesome.
And when you so in talking about how the laws, you know, you mentioned that you're able to spread the services out so that people don't necessarily have to come to Bethel, which is certainly an improvement. But the update to the law is important. But a very critical piece is law enforcement. If you don't have enough officers in communities, how do things get better? Do you still feel that there are certainly there's improvements here in clarifying what consent is, but what are your thoughts, Eileen, about that law enforcement piece?
Well, law enforcement is just a very, very difficult, you know, mess that I don't have the solutions for. I will say one thing that is another good thing coming from the Office of Victims of Crime is an investment in tribal victim services, local victim services. When people in their own community can address what's going on, if you've even got just a piece of it, like people who know how to get people civil legal protections, like protective order, or even know the options for sexual assault, because some people don't know, you know, that you don't have to report if you're an adult. You can do an anonymous report if you want to. You can go through the whole SART process. There's still like outreach and education that needs to happen for people to know what their options for if you're an adult. And I think that, you know, that investment in local victim services is really, really important. And they might be the, you know, until we can expand law enforcement and medical so that we've got whole teams in each community, you know, those grassroots programs of local community-based victim services are going to be, you know, critically important.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. We're out of time. We had a couple more emails that came in that were thanking folks for the work. And one person asked that we acknowledge Shirley Moses, the late Shirley Moses, who was instrumental at a national level, noting that Eric Holder placed her on a national task force.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Thank you for that acknowledgement. Thanks to my guests, Keely Olson, Executive Director of Standing Together Against Rape, or STAR, here in Anchorage, Eileen Arnold, the Executive Director of the Tundra Women's Coalition in Bethel, and earlier in the program, former State Representative Democrat Garen Tarr, who was instrumental in getting the law passed. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, and on the phones and social media today, Michael Finelli helped us out. I'm Laurie Townsend. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.